After a year in the audio wilderness, Pod's Own Country is back with a new series, Battleground Yorkshire, where I visit the region's key seats ahead of the next election. On today's episode, we are taking a look at the polls. I'll be speaking to the pollster supreme, John Curtis, about how bad a night the Tories can expect, and Luke Trill from More in Common about the elusive Whitby woman and how Kieran Rishi can win her over. Hello and welcome to Pod's Own Country, the politics podcast from the Yorkshire Post. A new year, a new podcast, and indeed a new host. I am Mason Boycott-Owen, the paper's Westminster correspondent. I'll be your guide as I take you the length and breadth of Yorkshire's green and pleasant lands to give you the inside story on the next election. So, what is all this about? Well, over the past month, we at the paper have been beavering away, analysing thousands upon thousands of pieces of data to find the most interesting constituencies that the main parties will battle over. The Yorkshire Post election computer has spat out 12 constituencies for me to visit in 12 weeks, each with a particular issue such as housing or crime that I will look at in depth. Every week I'll be speaking to voters, candidates, think tanks, charities and everything in between to see how the next election will play out. But before I set out on my grand tour and brave the UK's crumbling train network, I've assembled a crack team of polling boffins to see how things are looking for the main parties. First up, I chatted to polling expert Professor John Curtis, who paints a very bleak picture for the Tories' chances later this year. John, hello, welcome to the podcast.
It's nice to be with you, Mason.
What are we seeing from a national level in the polls at the moment? Just how bad are things looking for Rishi Sunak's Conservatives?
The honest truth is that things are looking pretty bad for the Conservatives. On average, at the moment in the polls, during the last 3 or 4 weeks, the Conservatives are running at 25%. That is 20 points down on what they achieved in 2019, and means they're still bumping along at the level that they were at in the immediate wake of the downfall of Liz Truss in October 2022. I mean, the big headline is that essentially the project that Rishi Sunak was meant to deliver, which was to reverse the damage that was done by Liz Truss's fiscal event, that project has so far made no discernible long-term progress. Labour, a bit lower than they were then. I mean, certainly one stage immediately after they were up at 50%. They're running at about 43. That's about 10 points up on where they were in 2019. But it does mean that Labour have something like an 18-point lead in the national polls, which means that in terms of the swing since 2019, you're looking at something like 14 points or so, which if it were to transpire would be a record swing from one of the biggest parties to another in post-war British history. So we, at the moment at least, seem to be a very, very different world from what we were before 2019, and certainly during the 2019 general election. And we seem to be on course for the Labour Party perhaps winning reasonably comfortably.
And what about Yorkshire? Obviously, historically, it has been more Labour than Tory, but was 2019 just a high watermark that they'll never achieve again? Or is there more hope than you'd assume?
Well, I mean, the first thing to say is that, yes, Yorkshire and Humber are somewhat more pro-Labour than is the country as a whole, despite the gains that the Conservatives did make back in 2019 in the region. But even despite those gains, Labour, with 28 seats, ended up 2 seats ahead of the Conservatives, you know, in sharp contrast to position across the country as a whole. Now, we do have to remember the next election will be fought on new parliamentary boundaries. Those boundaries, both across the UK as a whole and in Scotland and in Yorkshire in particular, don't make that much difference across the UK as a whole. It's estimated that if the election in 2019 had been held on the new boundaries, the Conservatives would have been 7 seats better off. Labour would have been 2 seats worse off. So it makes things slightly more difficult for Labour. And we should certainly bear in mind that more broadly, the electoral geography of the 2019 election was decidedly unfavourable to Labour, and that on the standard arithmetic, Labour might actually need to be nearly 14 points ahead of the Conservatives to get an overall majority. But that's something to which perhaps we might return. Within Yorkshire itself, it means that the starting point, rather than being Conservative 26, Labour 28, is going to be Conservative 27, Labour 27. If you follow through the boundary changes, I think probably, as it were, you know, what's the seat that's been switched? I think essentially it's the Hull West switch, seat, which was Hull West and Hessel, will now become Hull West and Halton Price. That moves from being a Labour seat in 2019 to a Conservative seat. But there are slightly more dramatic changes than just that. So that's point one. Yorkshire, as has long been the case, does have quite a high proportion of seats that are relatively marginal. If you're looking at the position back in 2019 and defined as a marginal seat, a seat where either Labour or the Conservatives won with less than a 10-point margin, there were 17 such seats in the wake of the 2019 election. Twice as many of them, almost twice as many of them, actually Labour seats, rather held seats rather than Conservative ones. So Labour are hanging on to a lot of seats by a relatively narrow thread. That figure goes down ever so slightly. It's now going to be 16 seats under the new boundaries. Again, most of them tending to be Labour seats. The Conservatives, in a sense, have a striking mixture of a number of seats which are relatively marginal, you know, five of them less than 10% majority, but there's also eight of them on the new boundaries where they have majorities of, you know, 35 points or more, and which you would think would be safe in pretty much any circumstance. So there's certainly plenty to play for in Yorkshire, and if you look at the moment at a 14% swing, and were to assume that that was going to happen everywhere, then the honest truth is that the Conservatives would be at risk of losing everything apart from those eight seemingly very safe seats within the region. And indeed, if you look at the evidence of a recent, now somewhat infamous, YouGov poll, which used so-called multiple regression and post-stratification to try and forecast the outcome in individual seats, that also points to the Conservatives potentially losing all but eight of the 27 seats they're trying to defend. And to that extent, at least, the picture in Yorkshire, according to the polls, could well end up being not dissimilar to that across the country as a whole, although, of course, probably still quite a long time for the elections, almost undoubtedly not going to happen now until the autumn. And of course, the Conservatives at least are hoping that although things haven't really changed very much for them in the last 15, 16 months, that they will change in the next 8 or 9 months or so.
You mentioned these eight safe Tory seats in the region. How much of a threat is Richard Tice's Reform Party? Obviously, their target audience seems to be a similar demographic to that which makes up the core Conservative vote in a lot of these seats.
Sure. I mean, it's a perfectly sensible question for two reasons. One is that if you look at the GBY polls, at the moment now, they're basically saying that for every one person who has switched from voting Conservative in 2019 to voting, saying they're going to vote Labour now, there's another one who says that they would vote Reform. So Reform are, in terms of votes at least, now posing as much a challenge to the Conservatives as are Labour. And of course, we do have to bear in mind that the Brexit Party, Reform's predecessor, did not fight what were, before 2019, Conservative held seats. So therefore, Reform intervening in those seats could have a particularly deleterious impact. That said, well, there is a big gap. So, I mean, Selby on the new boundaries is a constituency which we think the Conservatives would have won by about 28 points in 2019. So that's a 14 point swing mark. The next one, Beverley and Holderness, it's a 36-point Conservative majority. So it is a very big majority. Now, what is true, and in part, it's partly a consequence of reform, is that one of the things that the polls are picking up, and one of the reasons why you can end up with forecasts of, in the case of YouGov, 160 Conservative seats, in the case of electoral calculus, even fewer, is that we are finding, and the evidence was also there in the local elections last year, that support for the Conservatives is going down more in places where they were previously strongest. In part, this is an arithmetical inevitability. There are around 70 constituencies in the UK where the Conservative Party did not get 20% of the vote in 2019 and therefore cannot lose 20%. Indeed, there are three such constituencies within Yorkshire: Leeds Central, Sheffield Central, and Bradford West. So it's almost an arithmetic inevitability that the Conservatives are going to lose more ground in seats where they're strongest. Well, whether or not that pattern will be enough to potentially put these seats at risk, well, according to the YouGov MRP poll, the answer was no. According to electoral calculus, maybe in the case of a couple of them, it would. But I mean, you're right. Given that the Conservative Party is close to losing almost half the support it had in 2019, the idea of a safe Conservative seat they're going to be very rare. There aren't that many Conservative MPs at the moment who can be absolutely 100% sure that they're going to be home. Though it is probably true that the Prime Minister, with what is still a 47% lead in Richmond, North Yorkshire, is probably safe, though whether or not he would still be leader of the Conservative Party in the wake of the Conservative Party losing is probably a different question.
And what about Labour? Clearly they picked up a lot of support in the last few years, but is there any risk that they could lose that before polling day?
I would say that the principal risk that Labour face is that if you were to say, well, you know, in the end, any movement of public opinion is partly to do with push factors and partly to do with pull factors. So by push factors, I mean the things that mean that people are unhappy with the party they voted for last time and persuade them they should now be voting for somebody else. And by pull factors, I mean the things about about the other parties that they didn't vote for in 2019 that now positively attract them. Certainly, if you look at the history of what's happened in this parliament, there are really two crucial events. And really just two periods of 6 weeks where, in a sense, where we are at now is a consequence of. The first is the initial revelations about the way in which the rules on lockdown were more liberally interpreted in 10 Downing Street than virtually anywhere else. The Conservative Party, in the immediate wake of that, in December 2021, lost about 6 points in about 6 weeks. And for the first time in this parliament, difficult now it is to remember, for the first time in this parliament, the Labour Party moved into the lead in the opinion polls for the first time. And until then, the record of the Conservative Party for a party in government in the opinion polls was a remarkably good one. Then the second thing you already referred to is the Liz Truss fiscal event, in the wake of which, basically, again, the Conservative Party lost another 6 percentage points, again in a matter of 6 weeks, and again, it's the Labour Party that profited. So certainly, it's those events that seem to have pushed people away from the Conservatives. Insofar as there is a pull factor, well, it is that Sir Keir Starmer has succeeded in persuading people that the Labour Party is now a moderate party and not an extreme party. That's very clear. And that isn't simply a function of the events. But in other respects, has he persuaded them that he's somebody in whom they should have confidence in as an individual? Not necessarily. Has he persuaded them that Labour are ready for government? Well, certainly not as much as was the case for Labour before 1997. So there's just this whole sense of whether or not Labour have really sealed the deal. So I think Labour have made themselves sufficiently acceptable to be a repository of protest at a time when the government has made pretty much a hash of what undoubtedly was a difficult hand given the pandemic and the Ukraine war, etc. But the fact that reform are now picking up a lot of those protests is an indication, you know, of the apparent limits to what Labour are get. Yeah, and certainly, you know, despite Labour's wish to attract people who are in favour of Brexit, they've had some success in that, but not as much success as perhaps they imagined, and certainly not as much as they thought was essential to ever being able to win an election. And, you know, a lot of the people who are unhappy with the Conservatives but still believe in Brexit, they're going to reform. So you can see, therefore, how, you know, Labour's ability to profit, it's there, it's quite considerable, but it's not without competition and reform. You know, in the end, of course, if people go from Conservative to Reform, it's the Labour Party that's going to gain in terms of seats. So it's not too much for Sir Keir Starmer to worry about, so long as they do stick with Reform. But I think that the question is, you know, if the Conservative Party could possibly persuade the electorate that perhaps they're not doing as bad a job after all as hitherto people have thought, then perhaps the Labour vote might be vulnerable. It's just that so far, the Conservative Party, as I said earlier, have had remarkably little success in persuading people that perhaps they're not doing quite so badly after all.
Finally, let's talk about the Liberal Democrats. There seems to be a couple of seats in Yorkshire that they seem to have a chance of winning this time around. How are they going about that, as you know, they've not been a proper electoral force in the region for some years now?
Well, I mean, first point to make is that so far as standing in the opinion polls in general is concerned, the Liberal Democrats are not doing particularly well. I mean, one of the remarkable features of this parliament is how they have failed to profit from midterm protest against the Conservative administration. It's often thought to the place that people go to, but relatively few people have switched to Conservative Liberal Democrat. The Democrats, by the way, have lost a significant chunk of pro-EU voters to Labour, and that's one of the other things that's helping to push Labour up. Now, within Yorkshire, so far, I mean, the Liberal Democrats are basically betting the farm on being able to profit from Conservative misfortune in seats where the Liberal Democrats are in second place, and that people will not only defect from the Conservatives, but they will also be able to squeeze the Labour vote tactically. Now, most of those hopes are much further south in Yorkshire, but Harrogate is one seat where the Liberal Democrats stand off second. It's one of only two seats where there was a substantial Liberal Democrat vote back in 2019. And electoral calculus said that they thought the Liberal Democrats would pick it up. YouGov said they wouldn't, so who knows? But that is almost undoubtedly the one and only place in Yorkshire where the Liberal Democrats are hoping to pick up from the Conservatives. There is one, these days, very rare Labour-Liberal Democrat seat. It is, of course, Sheffield Hallam, which was the seat that Nick Clegg had. It was still very marginally Labour in 2019. Electoral calculus thought the Democrats would pick it up. YouGov didn't. I think, frankly, probably it's going to be very, very difficult to call what happens in any of the very small number of seats where the Democrats are challenging Labour. I mean, to be honest, my own view is the Labour Party have made so much progress in the national polls and the Democrats so little that I certainly at the moment would not necessarily have Sheffield Hallam on my list of likely Liberal Democrat gains. I think their hopes rest in Harrogate, which, you know, it is perfectly conceivable. If indeed they squeeze, you know, there isn't that much of a Labour vote left to squeeze, but if a new Conservative vote does fall very, very heavily, maybe the Liberal Democrats might just squeak home.
Professor John Curtis there, explaining just how daunting a task Rishi Sunak has ahead of him. But although all the polls seem to be pointing one way at the moment, there is more to voters than just percentage points and swing. Earlier, I caught up with Luke Trill, the UK director of More in Common, who has been researching the public's motivations for the way they plan to vote. Each election has the key stereotypical voter that the parties need to win over. In the past, we've had Essex man, Worcester woman, and Workington man. But finally, Yorkshire's time has come, and we've got one of our own. Meet Whitby Woman. Luke, hello. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
So, who are the main groups of voters that parties are trying to win over at the moment?
Well, what we've been trying to do is, obviously, quite well aware of the headline voting intention figures, which have Labour somewhere between sort of, you know, some pollsters at the lower end of Labour lead, like ours, have Labour's lead about 15. Others have it right up at about 25, 26. So whilst there's some disagreement about the size of the lead, none of us disagree that it's quite a large Labour lead. But what we've been trying to do a bit more is get under the skin of that and to look at precisely kind of who has shifted and why they have shifted. And I guess, crucially, how strongly these groups have shifted. And it's worth taking a bit of a step back to 2019, actually, to start with, because I think one of the things which has got slightly lost in everything that's come since is quite how impressively broad Boris Johnson's coalition in 2019 was. It included, you know, a group that we call backbone conservatives, you know, sort of conservative base. It included a group we call disengaged traditionalists. So this is sort of like, you might call them like white van person, sort of more likely to be self-employed, quite self-reliant. You know, and those two groups fairly traditionally Tory, at least in stature. But then it included these two groups who often feel quite different to each other. There's one group, we call them loyal nationals. They're very similar to what's become known as Red War voters. This is you know, that kind of socially conservative group, but quite economically left-leaning, who broke their historic ties with Labour and switched to the Conservatives in 2019 to give Boris his victory in some of those Red Wall seats, which, you know, there are a number in Yorkshire. But at the same time as winning that group, Boris held on to enough of another group we call established Liberals, which is your more blue wally voter. So this is, you know, the other end of the Tory coalition. They're actually quite socially liberal. They tended to vote Remain. But economically, they're more right-leaning. And so that was the coalition that elected Boris Johnson. And there were sort of three main things which glued that coalition together, which was, one, was just a desire to get Brexit done, even from some of the Remain voting segments. The second was actually Boris Johnson himself. For some of them, you know, and we still hear in focus groups from certain voters a bit of kind of Boris regret that he was a slightly different politician. And the third thing, and probably the most powerful glue, was Jeremy Corbyn. And all three of those factors have now gone, which means it's very difficult to keep that coalition together. You add into that the sort of, you know, the fallout from the mini budget, Partygate. And fast forward to today, and what you find is we have seven segments of the population overall that, you know, previously the Conservatives were ahead in four, Labour three. It's now Labour ahead in five of those seven segments. So going into the election, Labour has a coalition which is actually even broader than the one which elected Boris Johnson. So both that Red Wally segment, the Loyal Nationals, have flipped, as have that blue wally segment, the established Liberals, and Labour is hanging on to three groups that it kept, that it had in 2019. Progressive activists, a sort of Corbyn base, although interestingly, they're the only group where support for Labour is slightly lower than it was in 2019. Marginally, they 67% voted for Labour. Last election, it's down to 59% because some have gone to the Greens. Your sort of soft left civic pragmatist group and a group we call disengaged battlers, which is kind of quite an urban, economically insecure group. So there's this very broad coalition of voters who are at the moment saying that they are intending to vote for the Labour Party. And it is fair to say, I think, that the Conservative support now is pretty much limited to its base. I think we are down at the level where we have reached the kind of core Conservative vote. Now, within all of that, you know, there are of course different dynamics and different groups that we can talk about and dig into a little bit more. Because again, what you tend to find, what our research finds, is if you then take a step back from those segments and just look at, you know, I guess the groups that we're going to be talking about in the run-up to the election, which are basically two big groups, which is one is Conservative to Labour directly, and one is Conservative to Don't Know, and then maybe also Conservative to Reform we get onto. What's interesting about those different groups, and it's part of the challenge for the Conservatives in rebuilding their coalition, is they all want slightly different things.
And looking at the Conservatives, people within government are talking about damage limitation, focusing on a core vote to deny Labour a huge majority. What group of voters would the Tories pick to make sure that, you know, Labour aren't looking at a historic landslide?
Yeah, it's a good question. And, you know, I think the challenge for the Conservatives is that they are going to have to make that choice, because the current strategy of trying to rebuild the 2019 coalition in its entirety doesn't look likely to bear fruit. And actually, there's a risk for the Conservatives that they fall between two stools. And what do I mean by that? That is because, you know, lots of the more kind of, you know, what you might call red wall voters, again, we call them loyal nationals, you know, they are folk, you know, the Conservatives making a pitch to them based on lots of social issues, particularly migration. And there's no doubt, you know, immigration and small boats matter to this group, and they are frustrated at the government's failure to deliver on it. But they're more concerned about cost of living in the NHS, and they particularly, we find, don't like Rishi Sunak. That group of red wall voters, Rishi Sunak has never connected with them in the way that Boris Johnson has. And I think that particularly comes down to perceptions or reality, depending on how you look at it, of his wealth. And that he can't relate to the most real. So they're struggling with that group. The sort of more blue wall established Labour group actually like Rishi Sunak much more. They sort of, you know, when he came into office, they sort of thought he was David Cameron 2.0. And it's interesting, whenever you poll Cameron with this group, he does very well. They're the group who are most pleased about him being back as Foreign Secretary. But the danger is, by pivoting to try and win over those loyal nationals with the focus on immigration and social issues, you actually risk alienating these blue wall voters who should be the Tory base. And so you end up with that situation where neither wing is satisfied, which is basically where, you know, we're ending up at the moment, with the Conservatives stuck on their base, which leads to a Labour landslide. So I do think that the Conservatives have got to choose. And I think their options are reasonably limited. So the Conservative to Labour direct switchers, it is, from talking to them in focus groups, from looking at them in polling, it is really hard to see how you get that group back. In fact, our analysis is, had it not been for Jeremy Corbyn, actually lots of that group would have gone in 2019. They were the hold your nose and vote for the Conservatives, and absent Corbyn, unless something dramatically changes, I think the Conservatives and CCHQ will probably be writing that group off. You've then got what is a bigger group, actually, which is the Conservative to Don't Know group. And interesting, when you dig into that group, it is much more from those right-leaning segments that I talked about. They, you know, a good way to think of them is they're people who generally would vote Conservative, but are disgruntled, they are sat on their hands, they're fairly unhappy with particularly competence issues. They're a group that tends to say they're frustrated that the government appears so divided, they can't get their act together. It's less actually political disagreements, although, you know, they're just as frustrated about the NHS and cost of living as other groups. And I think all of our analysis indicates that how many or how much of this group the Conservatives managed to switch back from being Don't Know into the Tory column. And that means both stopping them going to Labour, but also stopping them sitting on their hands and not voting come the election, is going to be what determines the scale of the victory. And they're a really interesting group demographically, as you covered in the paper last week. If you look at that group of Tory to Don't Know, what's really surprising is they're overwhelmingly women. It is, you know, getting up to 70%. Of that group are women. Their average age is about 61. So, you know, early 60s. More likely than the average voter to live in a small town or a suburb. And when you think about it, and you think about, you know, you think about that kind of profile of area, and then you map that against, you know, the sort of seats which allow Labour to tip over into a majority, actually Whitby is probably quite a good proxy for where this vote lives. I mean, obviously you can go too far with these voter archetypes, but you know, my view is, you know, if 1997 was about you know, a Worcester woman, you know, 2019 was about Workington man, I think Whitby woman is the group who can't necessarily get the Conservatives back to a majority, as we talked about, because you need some switchers to do that, but they are the group that might just prevent Labour from getting an overall majority. I should just add as well, when we say that, you know, more women have gone Conservative to don't know, what's interesting is more men have gone directly Conservative to Reform. And there is a big debate in the Conservative Party about maybe we just need to tack right and we can win back these Reform voters. In fact, Jacob Rees-Mogg said, well, you know, if you add the Reform and the Conservative share together, it's quite respectable. But that just isn't how electoral politics works. So if you look at where Reform votes are coming from, it is true that more are coming from the Conservatives. So 59% of Reform voters are ex-Conservatives, just 5% are former Labour voters. So if you think about that, for every 100 votes that Reform gets, it nets Labour an extra 55 over the Conservatives. But then you ask the question, okay, imagine there was a Brexit Party style deal, as we saw in 2019, where the Brexit Party stood down in lots of seats. So imagine if you couldn't vote for Reform, where would you go? Only 26% of Reform voters say they'd go back to the Tories. So there just aren't that many gains to be made for the Conservative Party from trying to do that reform. And when we do focus groups with Reform voters, they're very anti-system voters. They are they're fed up with the status quo. I often say, if you listen to a focus group and they were talking about anything apart from migration, you might think they were Corbynites. You know, they are really, and again, we see it in our polling. If you ask a question about should the House of Lords be abolished, you know, Conservative voters disagree. Lib Dem voters, I think from memory, disagree. Labour voters narrowly agree. Reform voters are the strongest supporters of House of Lords abolition. And I think I use that as an example just to show these aren't just your sort of Tories waiting to come home. They are wanting to throw the chessboard up in the air, which is hard to see how Rishi Sunak wins lots of them back when he's also got to reassure the Tory base. And, you know, as I said, the sort of Whitby woman archetype who could define the election.
The current message from government and Rishi Sunak is, you know, stick to the plan, whether it's on the economy or any other of his five pledges. Is this chiming with the voters that he's trying to win back?
Well, you know, in some ways, I guess the dilemma, or no, the reality facing the Conservatives, is that stick with the plan is the only option they've got, really. So we saw, you know, in the autumn and run up to Christmas, Rishi Sunak try and pivot on this sort of I'm the change candidate narrative. And it just didn't land, right? You know, Tories have been in power for 14 years. But Boris Johnson can pull that kind of thing off. Rishi Sunak can't, right? You know, he's a much more establishment figure. So you bring those two things together, and then you're kind of left with stick with the plan as, you know, the only option. And you're absolutely right. And if you poll, do you want to stick with the plan or do you want change? It's, you know, over 70% say change. It is not you know, it's certainly not a 50% strategy. But, you know, again, you know, politics being the art of the possible, you've got to ask yourself, what other options are there for the Conservatives other than to basically hope that things like, you know, firstly, the economy improves, but things like the energy price cap reduction starts to filter through into people's pockets. We start to see interest rates coming down in the summer. Inflation will probably have a big fall in next month's figures. And so it's a bit of a kind of wing and a prayer, right? But, you know, when you're at this stage in a parliament and you're, you know, somewhere between 15 and 25 points behind. That is what you've got. And even that might not be enough, right? Like, the economy may be feeling much better by the autumn, but it was in 1997 feeling much better. And there's no doubt there is a significant number of voters that we speak to, and you really hear this in our focus groups, who are just done with the Conservatives. And I think, you know, how Rishi Sunak persuades that group back is really quite difficult.
That's all for this week's episode of Pod's Own Country. Join me next week, where I will be in York Outer, the first seat in our Battleground Yorkshire series. I'll be chatting to voters and the main candidates, as well as speaking to experts to find out what female voters want from the main parties come election day. If you liked what you heard, then you can subscribe to the Yorkshire Post for more interviews and analysis in print and on our website. See you next week.